Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We've got a particularly artsy show for you today, including painting, the written word, and music. We'll open up by learning about the Vermont Prize, then open up the phones. At 10, we'll meet the editor of Rutland Magazine, and we'll finish by learning about two upcoming music festivals. But let's begin with the Vermont Prize, which will be bestowed annually on a Vermont artist. Joining me is the inaugural winner, Will Casocondry of Juniper Creative Arts in Brandon. Will, congratulations, and welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Yeah, it feels good. Is Rachel there?
Yeah, she is. We've got Rachel Moore, the executive director of The Current in Stowe, and she is one of the Vermont Prize jurors. Rachel Moore, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much, Rick.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask our guests about the Vermont Prize, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Rachel, what exactly is the Vermont Prize?
Sure. The Vermont Prize was started by four organizations. It's a collaborative initiative of Brattleboro Museum and Arts Center, Burlington City Arts, The Current, and the Hall Art Foundation. And what we wanted to do was support artists in Vermont. And the aim at this new endeavor is to celebrate and support the very best visual art being made in Vermont today.
How many artists applied in this first year?
We had 251 artists apply.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's a magic number in Vermont, 251, the number of cities and towns in the state. How perfect.
Pretty incredible.
Well, I guess that doesn't take into account Essex Junction. But, Will, when did you become a professional artist?
Oh, we got to take it back to around 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I was about 24 years old when I decided to take that leap.
Wow.
So I've been at it for 20-plus years now.
And what drew you to art in the first place, Will?
I would say graffiti. Mm-hmm. Graffiti, comic books, you know, cartoons, things of that nature as a young kid. But probably around middle school is when I started painting, like around 13, 14 years old. And I fell in love with painting big in high school, like large-scale murals. I started painting murals at 17. And I was like, okay, I have to figure out how to make this work for myself because I really, really love painting large-scale. And I did work within the graffiti and street art movements in New Jersey. I'm originally from Trenton, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And that took me places far and wide, many places throughout the United States and overseas. I painted in London, Tijuana, Mexico. And I moved here to Vermont at the end of 2016. But I originally came out here in 2012 on the invitation of my niece, who at the time was a sophomore at Middlebury College, and also one of the students to my now wife, who I met at Middlebury College in 2012.
So
I got a unique history with Vermont, but I based myself here in December 2016.
And Will, what is Juniper Creative Arts?
It's a family collective. It's my wife, my daughter, and I. We go around the state doing community murals, centering BIPOC stories. We started Juniper Creative in January 2020, 2 months before the pandemic. So during that time, during quarantine, is when we really start putting together the mission as far as what we were going to go out into the world and do. But Jennifer and I have been collaborating on mural projects since 2017, 2018. But it's officially as Juniper Creative, January 2020.
Mm. Now, Rachel Moore, you're one of the jurors of the Vermont Prize. Who else decides on the winner or decided on this year's winner?
So we have four jurors representing the partner organizations. This year it was myself, Heather Farrell from BCA, the BMAC Director of Exhibition Sarah Freeman, and Hall Art Foundation Director Maurice Brand. And then we always have a guest, we will have a guest juror, and this year we were delighted and honored to have Kelly Baum, the Cynthia Hazen Polsky and Leon Polsky Curator of Contemporary Art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York.
Mm. And we just had Maurice Brand friend on the show a couple of weeks ago. Were there specific criteria used in choosing the winner?
You know, all they had to do, we were just looking for really exceptional work. So they just need to be residents of Vermont, just living and working in Vermont. It doesn't matter what age, what career stage. We're just looking for artistic merit.
Will, why did you decide to apply for the prize?
Actually, I got to give that credit to my wife. when we did some more research on the prize, I really don't enter contests or things of that nature. That's never really been my speed. But Jennifer was like, "Yo, this sounds like something that you should put your name in the hat, Will. Like, this sounds like you can really make some noise with this." So we decided to submit more of my personal illustrations and paintings, not the mural work, So this and the body of work that I submitted, majority of it was done during the first year of COVID. So I had the time. These are very detailed illustrations, super imaginative, Afrofuturistic in style. And this was just stuff that lived in my head, and I had the time to do it during quarantine. So it feels good to be recognized for that body of work. Yeah, it really does.
When were you notified that you won, and how did you react or celebrate?
Actually, it was an email. But the thing about it, it went to our business email, and my wife saw it before I did. So she, jumps up off the couch, oh, my God, oh, my God. I'm like, yo, what happened? I thought, a pipe busted something. I don't know. She's like, you got it. I was like, holy shit. I think I just sat there in shock for, 5 minutes, So,
Will's thinking he's got home repairs to worry about, and instead he's the inaugural winner of the Vermont Prize. So congratulations.
Yeah.
Rachel, how many, the different art, that was, submitted, tell us about, the things you did, go through, the 251 different artists. What kind of different art was submitted?
There was a variety of visual mediums. There were paintings and sculpture. There were drawings and video. I mean, it really was a widespread of work, from very established to very emerging artists, all living and working in Vermont. All visual art. So it was amazing, really incredible to see how much wonderful work there is being produced in this state.
And I want to peek behind the curtain, because you've got 5 jurors and 251 entries. So how do you winnow it down, and say, okay, here's the top however many, and then let's get it to this number, and then it's Will. How do you get that 251 down to 1?
It's so hard.
I know.
But it's, we went through all of them, which was a real joy for curators, to be able to see all this work that's being produced. So we really enjoyed the process, and we chose, maybe 5 artists that were our favorites. So we each had a top list, and then we looked at who was on the top, what the similarities were. So if there were shared artists on the top list, then they kind of made it to the next round and the next round, and until we were we decided on Will.
Now, Will, I know you won for your individual art, but I'd love to ask you a little bit more about the art that you and Juniper Creative creates. Where have you created murals in Vermont?
Oh, all over the state. Currently, we're still doing the Rec Pass, ground mural on a Rec Pass. But we have one at Stowe Middle, the Alchemist Brewery, Main Street Land in Burlington, all over the city of Burlington. We have a couple up in Northeast Kingdom, and I'm quite sure I'm missing a few, but we've been busy for the past couple of years. Over 20 murals in the past 2 years.
Wow. What types of subjects do you highlight in these murals?
We center BIPOC stories, black and brown stories. So we typically do murals. They're community driven. So this past year, we've been doing mostly school residencies. So we are going to a school, take a group of kids between 10 and 20, 25 max, and we come up with concepts, super imaginative. It's all student-driven concept, but we typically center as far as a model for the characters and beings we create. We typically center black and brown youth that live within the area.
Yeah. Now, one of those that you worked with is North Country Union High School. How were the students involved in that process?
Oh, first, it was a two-tier process. First, we went up in early spring. I think it was like early March. And this was during, you know, we were still like at the peak of COVID. So the students, they had a lot to share. And a lot of what came up is how they felt caged, you know. Mm. And we dealt with mostly art students with that group. And they came up with a super imaginative mural where it was a tree transforming into a dragon breathing rainbow fire that exploded this birdcage that released a rainbow falcon phoenix, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it was being led by a series of butterflies. We have a series that we call Afro-Pollinators, which we make the correlation between pollinators and specifically black people and how black culture is prominent throughout the world. But black people are also endangered, no different than pollinators. So we make that correlation when we're doing these community projects. Also, just to bring light to issues, you know, from life subject to very intense, because these kids are seeing everything in real time. The one thing about the youth that we're dealing with today is that there's really no filter the information they're receiving and how they're interacting with the world. Hmm. Like what our generation, where it took some time before we got information. Everything is instant. So we go through these mural projects over the course of 10 days. First were the students, and we is myself for 11 the student working in the work.
Oh, we're losing Will. It sounds like hit a bad cell pocket. Rachel, sometimes less is more, and the name the Vermont Prize has this unspoken gravitas along the lines of like golf's Open Championship or tennis's, you know, the championships Wimbledon. How was the name decided upon?
Well, you know, we worked together, honestly, to come up with a name, and we wanted something that felt that it encapsulated what we were trying to do, was also felt very prestigious, so that it was a benefit, a real benefit to an artist who won this prize. We looked at different prizes that were offered around the state, and we landed on this because we felt like it embodied what we were trying to accomplish.
And is there some kind of physical prize that Will receives?
Will receives $5,000 cash award to be unrestricted. He can use it for whatever he likes. And their work, the winner's work, is showcased and archived at the Vermont at vermontprize.org and on social media.
All right. Will, you talked about the Afro-Pollinators, which is absolutely stunning. One more of your artworks that is like a modern-day Sistine Chapel of sorts is the mural you created at Main Street Landing. It's called the Wall of Respect. Can you tell us about this amazing creation?
It took 11 months to install that mural. Of the mural in July 2020, and the production of the mural in October 2020. Around that time, history landed that they were closed better part of the following year because of COVID. And I said, Jennifer, well, let's tell the story we always wanted to tell. So the concept, Jennifer came up with the concept to illustrate and paint 230 years of BIPOC revolutionary history, starting with the Haitian Revolution. And we started a list of 36 artists, activists, you know, actively roots for 100. So, yeah, it took a lot of massages and some physical therapy to get through that one.
Now, some of it broke up. How long did it take to create that beautiful painting?
11 months.
11 months. Oh, yeah. My. And
all acrylic.
No kidding. The colors are stunning. The artistry is amazing. And thanks. Talk about, you know, painting a mural, something of that size, because you can have an idea, but to project that on, in this case, a ceiling, but also, you know, on the walls, it's got to be a completely different, skill set than just painting on a large canvas.
Yeah, well, the thing is arched. You know, it's an arched ceiling.
Yeah.
So everything was literally looking up and above. So when I would, for example, the center image is a picture of John Coltrane playing the saxophone, right?
Right.
So I remember as I was painting that, Jennifer would be on the ground, and I was like, hey, Jennifer, what does it look like? Oh, she's like, it's looking good, because I can only see literally what I was doing in front of me, like, as far as, like, a hand size length. I couldn't see the whole thing, you know? So it was a lot of up and down, up and down. We used the projector to project the images. Then I would go up, outline an image, and then fill it in freehand. So, yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot. The thing about it, the thing a lot of people don't know about that mural is that there wasn't necessarily a mock-up. We just came in with an idea. Ugh. So everything you see on that mural was created during that 11 months without a defined script.
That is stunning. Rachel Moore, what have you and the other organizers of the Vermont Prize learned from the first year of the competition that will help you in future years?
Well, I think that you know, there were a lot of successes with what we did with marketing and outreach. We garnered 251 applicants. It was we kind of set up all of our tools. There are a lot of little details to work out, but I think that, you know, this is just such an opportunity for us to see artists in Vermont, and also to have for artists to have a larger voice, for us to be able to show the nation what amazing work comes out of this small state, and such high caliber. And I think that, you know, as we continue to move forward, we think about, you know, the jurors. There are some details that I'm sure that we'll be thinking about, but we really, I feel like, had a very successful inaugural year. So we're quite happy with the way that it started.
251 seems like an incredible number for an inaugural effort. Did you have a number in mind? Did the group think, boy, if we only get X amount, it'll be fabulous?
You know, I don't think we had a number in mind, but we were just hoping that we had, you know, at least 100 maybe to look at. We were all talking about what our different respective calls to action or applications usually produce. So if, you know, for our own organizations, and those, you know, would range. So we weren't sure what to expect, but we were really pleased with the result.
I know you just announced your 2022 winner, but when does the application process begin for 2023, and how will artists be able to apply?
That's a great question. So artists can visit the website, vermontprize.org, and the applications will be coming, we'll start to receive them, I believe, in February of next year.
Now, Will, we've got a minute left, and I know you're working on a lot of these murals with Juniper Creative Arts, but are you working on any of your personal art again?
Yeah, actually, I started a new series of illustrations. After I got the notification that I won, I got motivated to start a new series. And I'm always working on personal work, but this this prize has definitely boosted my confidence, without saying. And, yeah, I want to produce a book. So that's something I've always been tinkering with. And I think with this announcement, that's something that I'm going to put into plans.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's Will Cassocondry, a renowned visual artist, graffiti scholar, and educator, and the winner of the first Vermont Prize. Also, Rachel Moore, the executive director of the Current and Stowe, one of the Vermont Prize jurors. And to learn more about the Vermont Prize and about Will's work, you can visit vermontprize.org. Rachel and Will, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a break for CBS News, then we'll open up the phones until 10. And the Red Sox have one more night off, so we'll have ESPN Radio at 5:30, Jazz with George Thomas at 7, and then Racing from T Road tonight at 8:15. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Well, this is the only open phone opportunity of the week, so dial us up at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. It's been hot here lately, and we'll probably stay in the high 80s. Granted, it's not England hot, but what have you been doing to stay cool? Care to share a favorite swimming hole or other wonderful spot where we can all stay cool? Also, I threw this out last week, but have you visited any places or events that you've heard about on the show? I loved when we did the show from Waitsfield, and our great listener, Bill Amaru, and his wife, Joanne, they hopped in the car in Corinth. They're from Mass, but they come up and stay in Corinth, and they drove over to Waitsfield, and they stopped in at the various places that they heard about on the broadcast that day, which was just wonderful. I think it's time that I also mention all the wonderful businesses and organizations that hosted us on that 90th anniversary tour, and I'll do that throughout this half hour. But for now, phones are open, and you can give us a call at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And, of course, you can always go to the Fred category and start your own topic. Because, you know, that's how we do things here. I will say that the WDEV 90th anniversary tour started on December 8th at Harry's Hardware and Den up in Cabot. And I was totally intrigued to learn about a place that was a hardware store and had a bar and a restaurant in it, and went up, walked in, didn't tell them who I was, just kind of cased the joint. And knew, oh gosh, this would be the perfect place to get things started. And sure enough, Joanna Thibault and Aaliyah Clary had us there, and they did such a great job of helping me find really interesting people from the Cabot area, and they kind of set the template for the entire tour. So a tip of the cap to them for taking that kind of leap of faith with me, the first remote broadcast there at Harry's Hardware and Den, and then for really kind of they kind of set the tone for the entire tour. All right, speaking of setting the tone, let's head to Cabot and talk to Michael. Hi, Michael. Go right ahead.
Hey, Rick. How you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to give you an update as we have breaking news, so to speak. We had an apartment fire upstairs over our space yesterday.
And this is Michael from the Scale House in Hardwick, which was the final stop on the tour. So I'm not sure I love this news, but tell us, Michael, what happened.
So, well, there's a long short of it. There's a little bit of water damage, and we won't know any more until the insurance adjusters come and go. But I just thought that before you got off carried away on talking about what we were doing at the Scale House, potentially.
Yep.
That you knew that we were going to be temporarily closed for what could be a week and what could be a couple months.
Oh, no. Well, I hope.
Yeah, no, it's not a fun experience, that's for sure. I dealt with it back years ago with Positive Pi when we had the same sort of water damage problem due to a fire. And it's a lot of it is just being patient to deal with the issues that, you know, order of operations.
Yeah. I think of places like Five Spice in Burlington. I'm trying to think of others. I think Hand of the Wood in Burlington also had situations like this. And it's a tough thing for a restaurant to go through. Hey, Michael, a couple weeks ago you called in. You needed somebody to come and play. You were looking for an acoustic artist. Did that bear any fruit? Did you get somebody to play that evening?
I did end up getting a new musician that night, actually, and it was not even anybody that heard us on the radio. It was somebody that happened to just stop by. They saw our chalkboard sitting on the sidewalk, and they just happened to swing in. It was a totally strange thing. And since then, I've added two or three musicians to the catalog, and we were about to get up to four nights a week of music. So we're looking forward to reopening when we do, and hopefully it's not going to be a drag our feet process.
All right. Well, hang in there. I hope to get back to Hardwick and the Scale House, and hopefully you're open. Keep us updated on what's going on there. Thanks, Michael.
You're welcome. Thank you, Rick.
All right. Let's head to the Duke of Newbury. Sir, you're next. Hi, Fred.
Morning.
Morning.
Remember, I'm the Duke of Newbury without portfolio.
Without portfolio. Yes, sir.
My oral address is, oh, I forgot what it was. It's Your Grace.
Your Grace. Grace. Yes, indeed.
Newberry. All right. We got that settled.
All right. Let's bring you back to Earth.
Yeah. Let's see. If I recall, you said you had a fascination with prime numbers.
I do.
And so do I. They're very interesting. I guess one of the biggest things that they use for is encryption. They have a... What they do is they have a long number with a lot of, you know, numbers and a lot of integers in the long number. And they're very difficult to factor out. So anyways, have you ever heard of a twin prime number?
A twin prime number? I have not. So what's before we go there, Fred, let's make sure everybody's with us. Prime numbers are numbers that can only be divisible by one and by themselves. So, 1, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, 17, 19, 23, et cetera. So.
That's right. And you know why one is not a prime number?
Oh, that's right. One is not. I usually throw it in there, but it's not. But tell us why.
Because one cannot be divided by two numbers.
Fair enough. It can only be divided by itself. Good point.
That's right.
Tell us about twin primes.
Oh, okay. So twin prime numbers are, I've got a list of them here somewhere. For me to run a telephone and an iPad at the same time is pretty tricky.
I'm going to throw something out there. Is it possible that like 13 and 31 or 17 and 71, would they be twin prime numbers?
No.
Okay. All right.
Here's the definition of a prime number. There's a difference of two between them. Like 3, 5, 7, 2, 11, 13, 17, 19, 29, 31, 41, 43, 59, 61, and it goes all the way up to 100, and there's less than 50, 20 of them, all the way up to 100.
All right.
I found that very interesting.
I do. I was thinking maybe they would be, the number when reversed is prime. You know, so 13 and 31 or 17 and 71. So there's two between them. So 3 and 5, 5 and 7, 11 and 13. All right, good. You're teaching me something, Your Grace.
Yeah, prime numbers are really fascinating.
They are fascinating. Really, yeah.
You can get a prime number list on the internet from 1 to 1,000, I think. And so what you can do is you can use the number, which is the number one, and then it'll tell you what the first prime number is. You follow me? Number one, number two, right?
Yep.
Got it? Number one is two. All right. So anyways, you can do that. So you can make your own code using prime numbers.
I love it. I always think that my best years are when my age is a prime number. And right now I'm 5 years away from my next prime, Fred. So I've got a long cold stretch coming up. All right.
I've already gone by my prime number.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Your Grace, the Duke of Newbury, Fred. All right.
There you go.
Take care. All right, phones are open. We're going to take a break. Ted from Shelburne, hold on. We'll get to you right after the break. I'm reminiscing about the 90th anniversary tour. You can do that. Let me know about past interviews that spurred you into action. Or you can talk about, like Fred did, whatever you'd like. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Phones are open at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. We've got Danny back. He had a few days off. He is manning the controls, so you get to talk to Danny when you call in. We're reliving the 12-stop tour that I took on the WDEV listening area from December through June. And I don't know, did you get to hear photographer Ethan Hubbard yesterday sharing photos and stories of our friends and neighbors from his new book, True North, Rural Vermonters, 1960 through 2010. If you care to comment on any of people you know and that you heard about yesterday. Also, the book is available Bridgeside Books in Waterbury, Bear Pond in Montpelier, Will's Store in Chelsea. Okay, our number's 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. Let's head to Shelburne and talk to Doug. Hi, Doug. I'm sorry, Ted.
Yeah,
hi, Ted.
Any name.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
I still have on my to-do list a trip to the Cabot Hardware. I've been to many interesting hardware stores because that's the kind of guy I am.
Yeah.
I've been there, and I've been to many interesting music demonstrations as well.
Hey, Ted, if you time it precisely, they do have music performances, usually on the weekends.
I have heard of little get-togethers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with people I know. That's a good one.
Yeah.
The Vermont Prize, was that what it was, the artist?
The Vermont Prize, yep.
Reminded me that a few weeks ago, a long-time friend called up and said, she had seen some of my work at Frog Hollow, because in the 1980s, when I was in the vicinity of 40 years old, I guess, and doing about as good pottery as I could manage, there was a permanent collection of Vermont crafts. And it wasn't apparently so permanent, but I'm glad that a remnant of it is on display at Frog Hollow.
Wow.
And I'm very non-digital, and I have hopes of doing every darn thing, and breakfast is next. but I hope to digitize some, because there are a number of things out there with my name on them, and I would just as soon in the surviving pieces in 50 or 100 years, someone could Google something or find a way.
Ted, are you still creating? Are you still
doing? I am not.
You're not.
The hero of the Scatcherd Potters is my brother George, who still is.
I have one of his beautiful lamps.
He is unable to stop. An art teacher called Mrs. Kramer at the Park School of Buffalo got him started. And that's the way it has gone, with a few distractions in between. But he is a heck of a knowledgeable and aesthetically marvelous and hardworking person. Anyhow, it's good to document the arts and
I will say
crafts as well of Vermont in a way that is sort of searchable or knowable, something that the state in some of its departments might try to establish a record of these things.
Ted, I'm going to have Karen Middleman from Vermont Arts Council on next Thursday. You know, she's stepping down, and maybe we can just suggest it to her.
Just the idea. And I have one week at art camp at Johnson there, Studio School.
Yeah.
And that was wonderful to have a place to stay and sleep and a community to be in and be fed and just play art. Because mostly, you know, my work is functional and therefore perhaps not as noble as aesthetic, but I was able to do art play for a week, and it was quite marvelous.
That's fabulous.
Well, anyhow, keep some record of the things that may be found in Vermont in the years and decades and centuries to come.
Great idea. Thanks, Ted.
Thank you.
All right,
bye.
That's Ted Scatcherd from Shelburne. Let's go to Doug now in Randolph. Hi, Doug. Go right ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
But I have a question for your audience.
Mm-hmm.
How come electric cars don't have solar panels on them?
And it's a great question. I think, Doug, and next time I have somebody on to talk about EVs, we'll talk about it. I think not enough is generated, to operate the car, but it does make some sense. You know, we're putting them on rooftops or on parking, covered parking, and it would seem as if there would be a way you could do that, but I'm not sure you can efficiently convert the solar power in the car battery you have. Now, I could be just talking total nonsense, but the question does seem as if that technology should be developed. It would make great sense, Doug. And if you and I can figure it out, I think we'd be slightly rich. So let's get to work.
Okay.
I'll be over. I'll head down to Randolph, get a haircut there, at Ken's Barbershop. And then maybe you and I can start working on figuring out this question.
Okay. I'll be waiting.
Thanks, Doug. Great question. And next time we have somebody on from EVs, it would think, you probably couldn't completely power the car, but you would think there is some amount that the car could capture of solar power to help operate it. I mentioned Ken's Barbershop. That was stop number 3 on our anniversary tour. Thanks to Tom Jacobs and the folks at Ken's Barbershop. They got the great stuffed catamount in the window. It is a biggest barbershop you'll see. They still have usually like 3 or 4 chairs, I think, going, and just such a family tradition to see youngsters coming in, which what was great was during our show that morning, which was back in February 10th, there was a young woman who brought her son in. I don't think it was his first haircut, but probably one of his first. They were coming in for a special occasion, and he had his hair cut. Stop 2 was with our great friend Troy Kingsbury down in Waitsfield at the Village Grocery. And this is definitely one place that I have stopped back in since that show, of course, to get the Brady Farkas sandwich, which is an incredible meaty sub. And if you're ever in Waitsfield and you really want probably one of the meatiest subs you'll ever have, the Brady Farkas is there for you, and it's of great value. But I also that day got some great wine tips. Now his name is escaping me, but Troy has a gentleman who used to work the Warren store who does help him with wine selection, and tipped us off on a very affordable Pinot Noir that I have gone back to several times. And speaking of gone back to, our fourth stop was March 3rd, and it was at the Elmore General Store, and probably the most community inclusive stop along the way. And I have that's Kate Gluckman and Mike Stanley running the Elmore store, and I've gone back for that wonderful Fire Tower pizza and for Ozzy's Osborne family maple syrup, and for the great pancake mix that is made right there in Elmore. Great stuff. I find myself loading up with a lot of things whenever I stop in at the Elmore store, but I have gone back several times in particular for the pizza. And it's only made on certain days, you know, certain evenings where you can pick it up fresh. But don't worry, there's a cooler with ones that you can take home and throw in the oven. So stop in, grab a pizza. All right, Danny, let's put the hammer down on the open phones. I want to thanks to all of you who called this morning prevented me from prattling on. We're going to take a break for news. Then we'll be back to meet the editor of the Rutland Magazine. And today at 1, it's Greg Hooker El Grande in the full-blown three-hour version of La Escapada, or The Getaway. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I'm always on the lookout to learn about what else is happening and what else exists in Vermont that I want you to share with you. Tomorrow, I'll have the author of a book on, and he sent along an article about him and the book that appeared in Rutland Magazine. Wait, Rutland Magazine? What? I had to know more. So joining me now is the editor of Rutland Magazine, Cassie Horner. Cassie, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Cassie about the publication, or if you're already a subscriber, call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Cassie, when and how did Rutland Magazine get started?
Well, it started, our first issue came out in the fall of 2007, so it's been, we are 16th year starting this year.
Wow.
And it came about because I was a freelance writer, my husband was selling radio advertising in Rutland, and we were getting in our age of our 50s and thinking, oh, what do we want to keep doing? And I had this idea that we could do a magazine, a quarterly magazine, very glossy, beautifully done, focused on community for Rutland County. I'd been working on other magazines, and still do, covering like Hanover and Woodstock, and had thought, oh, Rutland would be a prime space to have something similar, and so that's how we got going.
And has it been a prime space for it? Have you been able to find, for, gosh, 15, 16 years, stuff all around Rutland County to write about?
Oh, it's just been amazing. I mean, I know when we first started out, people would sometimes say, just that, is there any ideas? Is there a limit? How are you going to do this? Aren't you going to run out of ideas? And no, we've never run out. There's a list of people. People call me. I collect ideas. My writers collect ideas. So it's just unending, all the really positive, wonderful things about Rutland.
You know, you launched it kind of, you know, when the digital age had certainly become entrenched, you know. So considering starting a print magazine, why did you think that would be, you know, be a good idea?
Well, I think because I'd seen the success of similar magazines in Vermont, New Hampshire, and people had sent me magazines from other areas of the country. And I think what we have found is that a lot of things are digital, but our magazine is really beautiful. And we had decided from the beginning that we had to be able to support with advertising a really beautiful product. It couldn't be anything less than what our goals were. And because of that, people really look forward to it. People start asking, where is it? Is it almost here? I mean, we hear from some of the places that distribute for us, when is it coming? Our customers want it. And we found that even younger people love to hold it in their hand. They love to be able to flip through it, and they see local people, local happenings. And it means a lot to people. I mean, the Rutland Historical Society collects it, as does the Vermont Historical Society. has an archive of every issue we've done.
Great to hear that the younger people enjoy those, you know, of us who are a little older, that tactile experience of holding a magazine, you know, does appeal to them. I would imagine, too, Cassie, does the fact that you have decided to make it that hyper-local publication have, you know, relevance to those who subscribe and to who read it every quarter?
Oh, yeah, that makes a huge difference. For example, the latest issue, the summer issue, has on the cover this man named George Squire, who was known for his dahlias. He grew really gorgeous dahlias and into his, I think, his late 90s. And he's a really great picture of him on the cover. He looks like Vermont personified. He's holding a huge, like, dinner plate-sized dahlia. And we've had so many people comment to us that they knew George. They worked in a store where George used to come in for his garden supplies. I mean, it's that kind of thing that, you know, really touches people. And it touches me, too. I mean, grew up in Vermont and have a real love for this state, and I'm always fascinated by the connections that people find that, you know, root out all around a community and are really powerful, really beautiful.
What subjects do you try to cover in the magazine from quarter to quarter?
We have kind of a roadmap for covering things. Like, for example, we try to cover services such as, so one of the last issues had an article about Meals on Wheels. I mean, we have an upcoming issue. We'll have an article about SASH, which is a program that helps people stay in their own homes. So there's that aspect of it. Then there's saying the history. We have one writer in particular who grew up in Rutland. She's lived in the same house, I think, pretty much her entire life, and she does a beautiful job finding stories and talking to people who have really long-time connections. So we have, you know, a lot of history things about the area. We do ideas that people have about people. Sometimes something is sent in to us. Like, for example, Peter Cobb, who is writing the book To Alice, which I think he's going to appear on your program
tomorrow morning.
You know, he contacted me. So I have writers that call in. I have sometimes it's something for people to do. And occasionally we'll go out of the county, like we did an article about that famous Dorset Quarry, which is in right near Manchester, but it's close enough that people can do that. So that's kind of what we look for.
Yeah, let's talk about that story, the Dorset Quarry, which is one of those Vermont gems, right? And sometimes people in the northern part of the state, you know, don't know some of the wonderful spots like that in the southern part of the state. So I would imagine that even though you're so focused on Rutland County, that it's a great piece to pick up for anyone interested in Vermont to learn about, you know, places they wouldn't have been exposed to.
Right, and sometimes it can be, like, there's a woman who lives in Brandon who's a naturalist, and she's in a future issue going to write about owls in Vermont, and she talks about where she's seen different owls, and so it's an opportunity for, again, like you say, for people to go and discover something, to get out on the road and look around where they live.
Cassie, what's your background in writing?
I started freelance writing. I was working at VINS, Vermont Institute of Natural Science, and I wanted to do some more writing, and I had seen the Rutland Business Journal, and they were looking for writers, so I started doing that on the side, and I've done a lot of freelancing. Then I started doing it full-time, so I've written for a lot of, like, there's a Hanover magazine. I've written for Norwich Times, Queechee Times, a lot of the business journals. I wrote for the Rutland Herald, food column for a while, Vermont Standard and Woodstock. So that's my background.
Yeah, and you're still doing some writing for the magazine, but you're running a magazine. So how has that been? You know, it's quite a difference between writing stories and now putting them out in a publication.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And I'm doing the magazine. My husband, Tim Sink, and I co-own the magazines. We're the publishers. And as you can imagine, that's a challenge because we had our own separate jobs, and then suddenly our job is our job, and we work out of our house. And it's a lot of freelancing. You write, you interview people. It's like, oh, there it is. But of course, as you know, with a magazine, there's a lot of details about how it's published and where it's published and how the ads are selling and, you know, what kind of space we have and who the writers are. So, yeah, it's a challenge. I mean, and I had thought, because I'd written for weekly publications, oh, quarterly, that's going to be no big deal. But, of course, it was a really big deal. You know, it's a major, major undertaking.
Oh, I love that. And I believe Tim is focused on the advertising side of the operation.
That's correct.
Yep. Okay.
And he does. He also, he's an excellent photographer, so he takes some of the photographs as well. And we have some writers that take photographs, but Tim also does some of that. So he'll connect up with a writer, does the story, and then he'll connect up with the subject to take pictures.
And as you mentioned, stunning photography in Rutland Magazine. Who else do you have writing for the magazine?
Well, Mary Ellen Shaw, she's the person I mentioned that's lived in Rutland her whole life up till now, and she does really beautiful work, does gardening. She focuses on gardening and also on local history. Sandy Gartner, who's also local to the area, has a focus a lot on the arts. I have Paul Post, who actually he's the one writer who isn't in Vermont. He lives just over the border in Glens Falls, and he has a long journalism history, and he'll write about all kinds of things. He most recently had an article about the history of baseball, because Rutland had some famous people that came to Rutland.
Cassie, as you mentioned, the magazine, Rutland Magazine, is a quarterly, so you're not going to be having breaking news stories. How do you decide on what stories to include in each edition?
Well, I have the general format of trying to include some, you know, feature type things, which might be a major, you know, more of a major article, and then there's some department things that might be smaller things going on. You know, it could be like the Pulteney's chili cook-off, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And usually, I mean, I have different writers. I have a steady team of writers, and different writers work differently. So with one person, I have stuff from her ideas scheduled into next year. Other people, it's more immediate, and sometimes people suggest things to me outside the community, you know, outside the writer community. So I generally try to keep a notebook of ideas. Some of them are set in stone. Others will come into place, you know, closer to the time when my publication deadlines are.
Before the break, you mentioned Paul Post and a story he's written about Rutland baseball, and this really caught my attention from a recent issue, the story about baseball player Tony Mullane. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, he came to Rutland. I'm not a baseball fan.
That's all right.
Paul is, and that I should add, that's one of the things I love, is that different writers have different big enthusiasms,
right,
that they share, and I really like that. So yeah, Tony Mullane, who was he never got the ultimate distinction, but he had a good career, 14-year career, and he ended up coming to Rutland because he had been suspended by the Cincinnati Reds because he wouldn't play without a pay raise, and this was like the 1880s.
Mm-hmm.
So he stayed active. He came to Rutland to pitch, and so he was here a short amount of time and expressed the fact how impressed he was with the local talent. And he was a very colorful, he had all kinds of issues. He was accused of threatening to kill his wife. He was always doing things he shouldn't have done. you know, within that they, he was accused of throwing a game. So it was really cool to, for me to see, oh, someone like this had this sort of a brush with Rutland that people were really excited about back in that era.
Cincinnati Reds were the first professional baseball team. And it's a perfect adjunct. We had a writer on last Friday who did a story about the first African-American professional ball player who played in Montpelier for a short time. And so this is, if you've read that story, the Tony Mullane story would be a great one to read, to hear about, you know, baseball in the 1800s here in Vermont. In this far flung little corner of the world, we had, some interesting players come here and play ball. In the latest edition, you also write about a place that, next time my brother comes, to Vermont, I'm going to have to take him to dinner, to Casey's Caboose in Killington. Tell us about this place.
Well, it's a lot of fun, and it has some old cars, train cars, and that it was built around that. And a man from England took it over. It had been in pretty bad shape and has revitalized it. And you can eat outside. There's an incredible burger menu, and it's a really fun place. And when I've been there, kids love it too. You get families come, and you know, it's really a fun place to eat and simple. Just really, it's easy, informal. You can feel comfortable going there, and so I was there the last time before going to the Killington Music Festival concert, and it's just a lot of fun, very lively, and good part of the Killington community.
How many copies of the magazine do you print each quarter?
It varies. It's been as high as 10,000. You know, some quarters are more active than others. We've had some, one of the challenges has been COVID, because we did some mailing. We switched to mailing, a lot of issues for a while during the lockdown. And we've had some paper challenges. A lot of printers are having paper issues because during COVID, a lot of the paper companies apparently went to printing. They were doing boxes, cardboard boxes, corrugated cardboard. So that's changed the paper supply. So that's changed things for us as well.
And how about on the digital side, Cassie? Do you have a lot of digital subscribers?
We don't do that formally. We do put the magazine on the website, each issue, and people are directed there. People can go there. We do have some subscribers. It's not a whole lot of people subscribe because it's a free magazine, and it's distributed out, but people do, people with connections to Rutland, you know, from Pennsylvania and down south, and we have some subscriptions from those people.
How far and wide is the printed version distributed in retail outlets?
It's printed from Brandon, and we do take magazines to Manchester, Vermont, and then over toward Fairhaven, and then into Killington. That's our range.
Now, another fascinating story that I enjoyed seeing in the latest issue was the rebuilding of Brandon after Irene. And I live in Chittenden County, but the photos took me back in those times driving through the town as it was trying to put itself back together.
Tell us
a little bit about the Brandon story.
Well, I live in Plymouth, Vermont, and so were certain towns that got hit really hard, like Mendon, and Brandon was one of those towns. So it really hit hard. It really, places where rivers went through, and it really gutted places out. So it was interesting to see, I mean, the phenomenal efforts of communities to recover and rebuild, and you know, to see what they had to contend with and how successful they were in coming back. It was pretty amazing.
I think I remember one building being lifted and taken across the street and deposited over there, in Brandon.
Yes.
And it's,
and you can still see that in places. You can see where, you know, where the water came down, you know, where there were almost slides, I guess, into some of the rivers.
What are some past stories that you've really you're really proud of that you've featured in Rutland Magazine?
Well, I've really I've enjoyed, for example, the well, it's not that far ago, long ago, but we did a story about pickleball, which was fun because it was nothing I'd ever heard of, and, and then you know it just kind of spread out, and I keep meeting people. You know, who it's played on, it's like a tennis court, yep, with a paddle. And it's interesting because, you know, like I said, you go from not hearing about something ever. And then people say, oh, we play pickleball. Oh, you should come and play pickleball. And so that was a lot of fun. I think that we have some old time sort of friends. I think, like we've done some Sugar and Spice in Mendon. They do things for the community, and we have one issue. There was a photo on the cover of their old sugar house in the fall, with all the, you know, leaves around, and I love that cover. It's like it always makes me feel good to think about it. And there's some community projects, like the West Rutland Boardwalk, which again engaged a lot of, in this case, a lot of young people came in to work on that one season, and my husband went out to take pictures a couple times and met young people, and it's just really, really enervating. It just feels good, yeah, to know we did that.
We've got a minute left. 16 years after you and Tim got this magazine up and running, can you look back and feel satisfied with what you've accomplished?
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. I think that Rutland is a really wonderful place, and my husband always says that Rutland has always been good to us. Like, he always felt embraced by Rutland, that, you know, the people are really wonderful, and I think that's been one of the best things about it, is all the people that we've gotten to know.
Any plans for the future of the magazine?
I'm sorry?
Any new plans for the future of the magazine? Any way you'll expand it?
I think not at this point. I think that we're, you know, going along well and feeling good about, you know, what we're doing. I do have I'm going to have another novel coming out, so I just wanted to toss that in. I wrote Lucy about one of my ancestors, and I'll have a new book about her son Charles coming out soon. So that's kind of my other side of doing there's the journalism part, and then there's the fiction part that I've always loved.
You better get me a copy. Cassie Horner is the editor of Rutland Magazine. To learn more, you can visit rutlandmagazineonline.com. Cassie, thanks for being on with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. We'll take a CBS News break, and then we're going to hear about a couple upcoming music festivals in Montpelier and in Stowe. And coming up today at 11, Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. A tip of the trombone goes to WDEV jazz host George Thomas for tipping me off about two music festivals that he'd like our listeners to know about. In a few minutes, we'll hear about the Stowe Jazz Festival. But first, we've got Michael Lewis Smith, who is with us to get us pumped up for this weekend's Maple Roots Festival, taking place at the Morse Farm in Montpelier. Michael, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Glad to be with you.
Glad to have you. What is the Maple Roots Festival, Michael?
So the Maple Roots Festival is, so this is the second annual Maple Roots Festival, which is a festival that features local and regional acts at the Morse Farm Maple Sugar Works in Montpelier, Vermont.
When and where will it be going on?
We're going to be kicking things off Gates open at 3 p.m. this Friday, July 22nd. And we will also be starting things off on Saturday. Gates open at 11. And we have about 75 musicians performing in 16 bands on two stages. We have some food trucks, beverage tent, and lots of great stuff for kids and families, too.
And do people park right there at the Morse Farm?
Yes. People park right at the Morse Farm. The festival is free to the public, but there is a charge for parking. And, there's parking right at the farm when you're on site. Grab a parking pass and good to go.
And how late each night will the festival be going on to?
The festival is going to be going till around midnight each night, midnight at the very latest. Fridays are earlier evening, but we're going to go as late as we can. I think there may be a town ordinance that says we have to end at midnight. So it'll be right around then things will wrap up. The last band is scheduled to go on around 10 p.m. each night.
Now, you said it's the second annual, Michael. When was the first one held?
The first one was almost exactly 1 year ago. It was July 23rd of 2021. And last year, we had the music at the farm, and at the very last minute, we had to move things inside to the Sugar Shack, where the stage was, which was intimate and very cool. But we're very happy to be presenting it on a sizable outdoor stage provided by our partner, Catamount Arts.
Oh, great to have them aboard.
We're going to have a second stage, which is called the Jambulance, which is a modded-out ambulance with a stage and sound, which is pretty cool, too.
It is cool.
So we're going to have some smaller and up-and-coming acts on that stage and some great bands all around on both stages.
Now, I know the late Tom Morris had something to do with getting this festival started. Tell us about what his involvement was and how you'll be honoring Tom Morris this weekend.
Well, Tom was, our co-founder, and he actually came up with the name Maple Roots, when me and my co-director Dan Ryan came up with the idea for the event, we automatically called our friends Rob Morris and Tom Morris because we knew that they were looking to maybe do something on their farm and had done things there in the past. And really, last year working with Tom and getting to know Tom was the best thing. I always been really close with his brother Rob, and Tom was always kind of Rob's brother to me before we started working together last year, but I really got to know him as just a fantastic musician he is and just a fantastic all-around person he is, and hardworking guy and family man and just a great guy all around. And we're going to be honoring him with two sets of music. We're going to be honoring him basically by carrying on the legacy of the festival. But the first night on Friday evening, the Morris Davidian Family Band will be performing in honor of Tom. He was a member of that group. And on Saturday, Joe Davidian will be presenting a band that he's calling the Trumpet Titan Tribute. As many of you may know, that Tom was a fantastic trumpet player. And so they're going to honor him by playing some of the music that they think he would have liked. And one of the things that we're also trying to put together is a scholarship fund for a young up-and-coming musician in Tom's name, and maybe some other things to honor him.
Nice. Speaking of up-and-coming musicians, what can you tell us about the Kingdom All-Stars?
Kingdom All-Stars are, they're a band of mostly young people. I think they're, I don't think it's they exclude older musicians, but it's mostly a youth-based project from the Northeast Kingdom. And I'm very curious to, I've never actually seen them myself, but Todd, who is the director of that group, reached out to me and had interest in performing. And, you know, I think it was important for us to, in addition to having a lot of activities for kids and families and a kids band and kids parade, to have, you know, a community band featuring youth musicians.
I think they won a high school competition recently. And you mentioned 75 musicians, 16 bands. Who are a couple of the others that you want to highlight who will be performing at the Maple Roots Festival?
Well, I definitely want to highlight that Montpelier's own Sata Sound will be coming to perform with reggae legend Carlton Livingston. And they're going to be our headliner on Saturday. I think it's really cool that we're able to get some reggae this year.
Yeah.
The musician is, or the festival is put on, you know, by musicians for music lovers. I'm a musician myself, and my co-director Dan Ryan is also a fantastic, amazing drummer, and. So we didn't have any reggae last year. We had a band that played some reggae, but it's nice to have a straight-up reggae artist. And Matt from Sata Sound, Matthew Delury, has been doing it for 20 years in the area, bringing great reggae and dancehall to northern Vermont and the surrounding region. So that's going to be a new thing and a highlight. And we're also going to have some other great local talent, as I mentioned. You know, Joe Davidian's going to do his thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Chorney,
yep,
will be bringing Freeway Clyde, which is a great band. I've never seen them live, but I've heard some great things.
Michael, a Tony Award winner. You mentioned that the performances are all free. There's a fee for parking. But to help defray costs, I know you have an online auction going on. Tell us about that, Michael.
Yes. Thanks for bringing that up. So we do have a silent auction with some really cool stuff on there. You know, friends and community members have generously donated some really cool items, including a stay at the Treehouse, which is an Airbnb in Hardwick that's really unique and cool that people come from all around to do. And lots of other little odds and ends. Cabot Creamery donated some things, and other local businesses. There's also a music studio, Tank Studios, which is a local music studio, has donated some studio time. There's a lot of stuff on there for guests to check out for the silent auction, restaurant, and food items and things like that, fun stuff. I'm pretty sure there's some maple syrup from Morse Farm that they put up there. Michael Chorney has some vinyl up there,
yep,
which is pretty rare. And we also have, we're accepting donations through our partner, Catamount Arts. So if anyone, in addition to the silent auction, is able to donate, it would be much appreciated and would go straight to supporting all the musicians and the great folks that are putting this together, in addition to myself. It's really a good cause and a great thing, and everyone's worked really hard, and it's going to benefit a lot of musicians, and it also benefits the local economy, and I'm really proud of what we've built.
The Maple Roots Festival is tomorrow and Saturday. It's at the Morse Farm in Montpelier. You can learn more and bid on the auction items at maplerootsfest.com. Michael Lewis Smith, thanks for being on the show this morning.
Thanks, Rick. Have a great day. Thanks to all the viewers, the listeners. And we hope to see you there this weekend, guys.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be back to learn about the Stowe Jazz Festival. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. All right, this weekend is the Maple Roots Festival. You can enjoy that and then take a couple weeks to recuperate and then head to Stowe for the Stowe Jazz Festival, which is taking place on August 5th, 6th, and 7th. And here with the deets is a very jazzy individual in his own right, George Walker Pettit. George, thanks for being on Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, good morning. How you doing, Rick?
I'm great. How about you?
Pretty great, man.
Good. George, give us a little history lesson of the Stowe Jazz Festival.
Oh, my pleasure. Oh, and by the way, I'm drinking a big hot tea here. If I have a minor cough.
So all right.
In advance.
No worries.
Well, this is an idea that I started in 2016. It took about a year to pull together, and our first festival was 2017. We had 3 years to prove our model and grow from 400 attendees to 4,000. And then COVID hit us. The Great Plague came in, so we put everything back burner for 2 years, but this is our comeback year. The festival basically, it's a 501c3 nonprofit now. We have 26 groups in 6 or 7 Stowe venues, one of them being our primary main stage, which is on the grounds of the Alchemist Brewery. We have a main stage band shell there and full concert system and lights. And that venue will have 4 groups a day for the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the 5th, 6th, and 7th of August, starting at 1 in the afternoon, going till 9 at night. So 4 groups a day, 12 groups there. And the balance of the shows are happening at indoor venues in town, like Cork Wine Bar and Doc Pons and Picasso and Plate, et cetera, et cetera. And the biggest and most important thing for our regional folks to know is that because we're a nonprofit, we don't charge anything at all for the general public to come to any of the shows. There are no tickets to be bought. There are no cover charges. There's no parking fees. A lot of reasons for that. I think the main one is that the main two are, number one is that we like to look out from our stages, et cetera, and see families out there as opposed to just folks who, quote unquote, can't afford it. That has a great impact on the community and on jazz. And it's a bit of a breaking of the general model of jazz festivals, which I personally enjoy, having played at a lot of them and having attended more. On the other side of that is, because we don't have a profit motive, we can invite the best of the best musicians and not really have to worry about who is going to draw and sell tickets, because we're not selling them.
That's right.
That's kind of it.
Yeah, you've already sold all the tickets that you possibly want to sell, which is zero.
It's funny. We were asked a couple of years ago by a major corporate sponsor if we could give them any VIP free seat. And they asked for 25, and I said, actually, I can only give you 50. And they didn't quite understand. And then I said, my final offer is 75. And the fellow said, what is this about? I said, there are no VIP. Look, VIP in music doesn't make any sense to me, because if you put 3 people in front of a Picasso in a museum, they all have different financial or socioeconomic backgrounds. They're all entitled to their own opinions, and they're all also entitled to access to that art. That's where we're coming from on that.
Nice. Now, you have put together a great lineup. Tell us about some of the jazz artists that people will hear over the festival weekend.
Okay, cool. Well, obviously, they need to go to our website so they can see the entire schedule. But to hit on that briefly, on the main stage, let's see, we have John Davis's trio. John was out with Jaco Pastorius for years. Mm-hmm. The Ben Allison Quartet, including Steve Cardenas, and just a great group there. We have Elio Villafranca, brilliant Cuban musician. He has a sextet coming, and part of that sextet is Donina Caslin. Alan Mednard is being included as a drummer. We have Jonathan Marin's quintet that same evening, which is an electronic jazz quintet. Jonathan was instrumental, sorry for the pun, in starting the Groove Collective. On Saturday, we have Grupo Los Santos, and the percussionist on that group is a fellow named Max Pollack. If you go to the post office and you ask for a line of stamps or a block of stamps, for the recent tap dancing issue. He's right there on a U.S. stamp. He's probably the finest tap dancer percussionist in the U.S., if not the world. Then we have Ed Cherry, his quartet after that, which this year is including the phenomenal, besides Ed's phenomenal playing as a guitarist who played with Dizzy Gillespie, also in his band is Peter Bernstein. Then we have Chico Pinheiro's quartet after that with a special guest, Amanda Brecker. And then from Peru, after that, we have an octet, Festación. Excuse my terrible pronunciation.
We'll let it slide, George.
Thank you. Sunday, we have Tyler Blanton's quartet. Tyler is a great vibraphonist in his quartet. Gary Brassais is in there. After that, John Fedchok's sextet from New York City with some other ringers, including Dave Fink and Tim Horner as the rhythm section. After that, Allison Miller's quintet. They come back. Allison brings her group every year. Offhand, let's see, Tony Shearer is playing bass in that, and Terrell Safford is playing in that group as well, Safford. After that, Manuel Valera's sextet. That's what's going on in the main stage. But, of course, we have all these other venues with some top-of-the-line Vermont artists and some other out-of-towners as well.
George, when you're putting together this lineup, what kind of effort do you put into providing a variety of jazz styles?
As much as possible. You know, we keep saying we're not pure jazz. We're always jazz and always free. Stylistically, you know, jazz has so many subgenres, it's tough to really define.
Right.
But what we try to do is we try to identify groups that are really calling on a certain degree of the tradition of jazz and the lexicon, the language of jazz, as opposed to jammy groups or blues groups, all of which I quite enjoy and, by the way, play in. Mm-hmm. But that's not what we're after. Of course, there's a tremendous amount of group and individual improvisation in all the jazz we book. But we really do try to find a line of continuity back to the jazz traditions. And then looking at that, we try to bring jazz as it's read from the United States, from Cuba, from Brazil, from Israel, from, you know, from all parts we can, because everybody has a bit of a different read on the same styles. So we're just trying to keep things as diverse as possible, not only in the music, but in who's playing the music, inclusive as possible. And at the same time, again, bringing stuff up here, we probably wouldn't get up here if we had to justify everything by a financial motive.
What do you hope those attending the jazz festival will experience throughout the weekend?
A lot of fun. and we want to open people's eyes. I mean, we have, over the years we've been operating, we've had a lot of people hear a group that we've had up here and say, wait a minute, that's not jazz. What is that? And that makes me smile. Because jazz doesn't have to be, you know, a walking upright bass and, you know, a accessible bebop melody. A lot of folks that come to listen don't really grok, don't really understand that language, and we want to bring them in. We want to challenge people and at the same time make the music accessible. Of course, jazz is something that has to be experienced live if you can. But we want people to have a good time and enjoy the community and walk away kind of shaking their head saying, wow, that was something that was just totally unexpected, and I'm coming back next year, you know, with my cousins and their kids and the whole crew.
We got about 30 seconds left, George. Food, drink available during the festival? What do you got?
Yeah, I mean, all of our indoor venues have food and drink. And again, no cover charges. Some of them do drink specials, like, you know, if it's a New Orleans kind of vibe, they'll do a hurricane. On the main stage grounds, we have phenomenal catering this year from Live Forever Foods. We have the support of The Alchemist, of course, and their insane ales.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, the support of Vermont Wine Merchants, Mike Sterese and his people over there. They'll be pouring not only Archer Roos canned wines, but also three bottled wines from Europe. I'm still trying to fill the ice cream vendor slot. But there's, yeah, I mean, you can also bring your own sandwich if you want to do that. But you can't bring alcohol to the grounds.
All right.
That's a good booking.
To learn more about the Stowe Jazz Festival over the first weekend in August, you can visit stowejazzfestival.org. George Pettit, great having you on the show. Thanks so much.
Hey, man. Thanks so much for having us, and I look forward to seeing everybody up there. Track me down, Rick.
All right, sure will. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan, and please feel free to suggest guests or topics for the show by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sarah is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we hear from Bob Ney and then talk about Bear Conflicts, the book To Alice, and the Department of Labor's Job Fair at a Mountaineers game.